Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Christopher Bader, a professor of sociology at Chapman University and affiliated with Chapman's Institute for Religion, Economics, and Society. He was principal investigator of the first two waves of the Baylor Religion Survey, a nationwide survey of U.S. religious beliefs, and also the principal investigator of the first three waves of the Chapman Survey of American Fears. Sounds scary. He is associate director of the Association of Religion Data Archives, found at www.thearda.com, and that is the world's largest archive of religion survey data, which is funded by the Templeton Foundation and Lilly Foundation, as well as being supported by Penn State University and Chapman University. For those of you interested in religion, this is a great resource for data and is extremely accessible, as they have a wide variety of tools to help folks explore various trends and comparisons in religious affiliation and other stuff. A really great resource for students and the general public. Dr. Bader is the author of two books, America's Four Gods, co-authored with Paul Froese, and Paranormal America, written with Joseph O. Baker and F. Carson Mencken, which is just being released in its second edition with NYU Press, and that will be the topic of our discussion today. Beyond these works, Chris has published several dozen articles and chapters in the fields of sociology, deviance, criminology, the sociology of religion, and education. He has three other books in progress, including Faithful Measures, Applications in the Art and Science of Measuring Religion, Fear Itself, The Nature and Consequences of Fear in America, and The Insiders, Studies in the Normalization of Deviance. He is a busy scholar indeed. All of this interesting stuff can be found linked on our website, including the link to the ARDA, so please pay us a visit. Chris, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tony.
You are the first guest that we have ever had back on our show to discuss the second edition of a book, which in the academic world is a really big deal. Most scholarly books, they're lucky if they can sell 500 copies, let alone get a green light to have the second edition commissioned by the publisher. So congratulations on that feat.
Well, thank you very much.
By way of further introduction, I should note that you've been studying paranormal beliefs for over 20 years, going way back to your time at the University of Washington. Go Dogs, number 5 in the NCAA polls this week.
And go Hawks.
And go Hawks as well. You've been on several ghost hunts. You've observed support groups for UFO abductees, joined Bigfoot investigations, and attended numerous psychic fairs and UFO and Bigfoot conventions. So kind of interesting research life you've lived there. And now I know that scholars are often defined by what they do early in their careers. And to many of us, you've become known as the Bigfoot guy, even though you've done lots of work in criminology and mainline religious beliefs and stuff. How is it to be known as the Bigfoot guy? Is that something you've come to embrace, or are you still trying to shake that?
Well, it's funny. It's funny to be known as the Bigfoot guy. I consider it nothing different than in the area of deviance, you have people who study prostitution, you have people who study criminals, you have people who study drug use, and we don't make the assumption because they study those things that that necessarily is what they are or what they believe or what they choose to do. But that's okay. I've grown comfortable in my skin over the years. I'm okay if people call me the Bigfoot guy.
And that's pretty cool, too, because if you ever get down to Chapman University, you should see his office. He has a whole mess of really cool stuff in his office, including the phrenology skull, which they used to use to measure criminology, the size of your skull or eyebrows or stuff like that. So very cool. As I mentioned, your book is coming out in a second and updated edition. How was the first edition received, and what was the rationale for composing the second edition?
Sure. Well, the first edition was received very well. NYU Press was very pleased with it and the reaction we received from it. And myself and my co-authors had a very interesting experience publicizing that book because we ended up talking to both academic and non-academic audiences. That I found myself sometimes on paranormal radio shows and television shows talking about the book, and I would find myself on podcasts such as yours and talking to academics about the book. So it certainly made for a really interesting experience. NYU contacted us a couple of years ago and said that based on the sales, they were interested in a second edition, and we actually had a lot more to say. We had newer data. We had continued to study people who have paranormal beliefs and experiences, had new field work to talk about, so we agreed to do it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what is new in the book? If you could just give us a top-line analysis. We'll be talking about some stuff in specific in a minute, but overall, what if I had an old edition of your book and was looking at the second edition, what new would I be finding there? Why should I pick it up?
Well, what we're very happy about is that it is, I would have to say, at least 75% of the material in that book is new or rewritten. And that was what we really wanted to do if we were going to produce a second edition. We did not want to do a second edition where basically there's a new introduction. So if you look at the analyses in the book, nearly every analysis, there's only a few where we couldn't do this because we didn't have the data, is based on very, very recent data. As of 2014, 2015 are most of the analyses in the book. So it gives you since the previous book was published in 2010, it gives you much more recent data on these beliefs. And for people who are interested in what paranormal experiences are like, what paranormal believers are like, every section of the book has new field work in it as well. We went to new Bigfoot conferences. We went on new ghost hunts. One of my co-authors, Joseph, took ghost hunting classes. So it's quite new top to bottom.
Yeah, I have to recommend this book highly, too, because it's the type of academic book that I like to read because it has the data. And I don't want folks who are not data-driven to be scared away saying, oh, this is just going to be a bunch of regression analysis. Data is presented in a very accessible form, top-line analysis of different kinds of stuff. It's all relevant to what they're talking about. But it's also a book that spices up everything with the field work, which is basically some really interesting stories that are woven in there to illustrate a lot of the concepts that you're talking about, and they're really fun because I know you personally, and you're a great storyteller. So that definitely comes through in the book here, and I'm pleased to see it.
Well, and that's one thing we really tried hard to do with this book is all the analyses in the book are based on complicated multivariate regression analyses, but we decided to hide that in the back. It's in the appendix. There'll be even more in an online appendix when the book comes out. So anyone who wants to delve further into that, they're welcome, and all the data sources that are part of the book are public. So people can check our work and ensure that our analyses are correct. But what we've done is once we've seen that an effect is statistically significant, we simplify it to present it in the book. So the book is pie charts and bar charts and simple, more graphical analyses.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you talk to academic audiences on this, and they oftentimes like the thicker weed, multivariate regression stuff, but you also talk to non-academic audiences. Just give me a sense of what the difference between those two audiences are and how do you pitch these things differently?
Sure. Well, to the academic audiences, they're oftentimes more focused on essentially what is the import of studying the paranormal? Why should we study it? Why should we understand it? How does it relate to other phenomena? So oftentimes with academic audiences, I end up talking about, and I'll probably talk to you today about how it relates to religion as a whole and deviant behavior as a whole. Frankly, the non-academic audiences, they oftentimes are much more focused, and that made for interesting interviews on what did we see? Did we ever spot a ghost or a Sasquatch on our various excursions? They want to know in a very more simplified way what paranormal believers are like, and particularly with non-academic audiences, they want to know, well, are paranormal believers just crazy? They'll use terms like that. So we're oftentimes talking more about the paranormal believers themselves to non-academic audiences and the paranormal experiences, whereas the academic audiences tend to focus more on the more complicated relationships between the paranormal and other phenomena.
Well, your book does both of those things actually very well, and I want to start off with an example that you lead off with in the book, and that takes us to your current institution. And when we last had you on, you were down at Baylor University, but now you're over at Chapman in Orange, California. And this area, which is kind of the land of surfers and strip malls, you'd think this would be one of the last places you'd think to encounter ghosts. But you have a really fascinating story from your new haunt, so to speak. And tell us what you encountered in your time at Chapman.
Sure. I was actually quite surprised at Chapman to have a professor tell me a ghost story. And that's what we chose to open the book with. Professor that I know very well, who will remains nameless in the book and will remain nameless here, came up to me one day and told me, I believe that a ghost was in my classroom the other day. And what had happened to this professor is he was lecturing in front of his class when all of a sudden he heard loud footsteps next to him, as if someone was loudly walking near him at the front of class. This was a standard lecture-style setup. He was standing in front of the class. Students were in rows of desks towards the back of the class. He said he was immediately disturbed by the sound because he looked to his right and was expecting to see somebody there, as if a student maybe had kind of snuck around behind him or something like that. And nobody was there, and so he shook it off and continued lecturing, like any good lecturer would do. He just shake off the distraction, continue lecturing. And he said, as soon as he started lecturing again, the footsteps very loudly, as if someone was stomping, continued in front of him and continued to his right and ended as if the person who was walking had walked right into a wall.
Hmm.
And at this point, when the louder footsteps echoed across the front of him and towards the wall, students noticed now at this point, and they stood up. Students were gasping, talking to each other. And I confirmed this. I was able to interview some of the students, and they confirmed for me, yes, we heard these footsteps. It was shocking. People started talking. Basically, the lecture was over at that point because everyone was wondering what had just happened. The professor immediately stopped class, and they talked about what everyone had heard and experienced, and they decided at that point to try to figure out what had made the noise. So they students started stomping around outside the room to see if that would produce an echo where he had been lecturing, and that didn't reproduce it, according to the students and the professor. They went to the next room and started stomping around. They went upstairs to make sure someone wasn't stomping around up there. They walked up and downstairs. So this to me was fascinating because the paranormal actually disrupted a class, and for the remaining 45 minutes of class, you had a professor and 30 students trying to recreate a ghost. And so I found this fascinating because to me this was a legend in the making. Every good university needs a ghost. You know, they need a good football team. They need a good ghost. Chapman doesn't have quite a football program, a very good football program yet. I'm sorry to say that. And so they need a ghost to get started, I guess. And so I ended up inviting a group of ghost hunters to come and investigate the place. And then what really interested me as a sociologist is I'm interested in how legends form. And what I found out talking to people in the building is that other people in the building would claim to hear strange noises, but there was no ghost yet. There was no story about someone who committed suicide in the building. There was no story about, oh, everyone knows that that's Carl. So I was fascinated to be there, essentially, in my opinion, on the ground level of a ghost being created or a ghost legend being created. And a benefit of being out here in Orange County and so near Los Angeles is that my contacts in the paranormal community have quickly involved people who are on all these paranormal TV shows that are so ubiquitous nowadays. So I was able to get a group of ghost hunters to come out and investigate what is Smith Hall on campus to attempt to find the ghost, which was it was fascinating to watch them and watch them do their work, so to speak.
And what was the outcome of this? Did they find anything? And also, has it become a legend at Chapman now?
It's starting to become a legend now. Now we hear more people talking about the ghost in Smith Hall. I was fascinated to be walking across campus one day and hear students talking about, and I saw a group of students pointing to Smith Hall and saying, that's the one that's haunted.
Mm-hmm.
And I've started to hear that. So I may be partially responsible for starting a new legend. I'm very excited to see in 50 years if that's the well-known haunted campus building on campus. The results, so to speak, are what they've been almost every time I've been on any sort of paranormal excursion, whether it's a Bigfoot hunt or something UFO related or a ghost hunt, is I've generally found that ghost hunters and Bigfoot hunters and other paranormalists have 100% success rate. They always find evidence of what they're looking for, at least every time I've been with them. And they always have experiences. So a couple of the ghost hunters that were there claim that they heard voices while they were sitting in one of the rooms when the lights were out. An entire group of the ghost hunters claim that they were in the room where this incident happened and they had the door closed and the lights off when suddenly there was a very loud knocking at the door. This was in response to them asking the ghost to let itself be known. They opened the door very quickly and no one was there. And so they take that as evidence that that was a spirit that was knocking on the door. Unfortunately, and this has been either my good luck or bad luck, however you want to think of it, I wasn't there. I was in another part of the building. So I talked to the people who were there, and they all told me about hearing the knocking. A psychic who was with the group believes that the ghost is living in a closet that's at the end of the hallway. That's where he likes to hide. I'm saying he because the psychic said that whoever this ghost was is a he. And so here's the legend, if you want to know, Tony. Here's what this ghost is going to become. The psychic has said that it's a he. It's a young man. And this is a young man who is extremely religious, did something bad in his lifetime, and is now afraid to cross to the other side because of what potentially awaits him. We don't have a name yet, though. That's when if we ever get a name, that's when I think the legend will really take off.
Yeah. Really kind of interesting to think that, a highly respected university like Chapman University wouldn't have something like this. But as we're going to find out later, this paranormal beliefs actually affect all walks of life, contrary to what our expectations would be. You don't just talk about what happened at Chapman University, though, too, but just in the local neighborhood, you have some other interesting tales. One of them that caught my attention was this Big Cypress Coffee House warlock guy. Who is he?
Yeah, I believe we talked about this last time we talked. Yes, but this was in Texas, and there is a town in Texas called Jefferson, and if anyone ever wants to visit a town that has been literally taken over by the paranormal, that's transformed itself by the paranormal, go to see Jefferson, Texas. Very picturesque little town on a bayou in East Texas, and it was a town that's been struggling for years until the stories of its hauntings became so prevalent that if you go to this little town in East Texas any night of the week, you'll find hordes of people taking ghost tours, going through all these supposedly haunted buildings in Jefferson. And ghost hunts have become really popular in lots of small towns and big towns across the U.S. But in this particular place, on the ghost tour that I took when I was visiting, the leader of the tour took us to a place called the Big Cypress Coffee House. And she told us that on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most severely haunted, this place is an 11.
Wow.
Sort of like a Spinal Tap. You know, this is 11. And she actually said that she was too frightened to go into the building because she'd had her hair pulled when she was there. So she sent us, meaning the tour group, into the building to talk to the owner. And the owner of the building, whose name was Dwayne, he told the group that he was a warlock and that he had bought the building because he'd heard about the stories of haunting and was interested to own a place that was supposed to be so haunted. And he told us stories about how there was a particular room upstairs that psychics had told him was infested with 150 angry spirits and demonic entities. And that he used to allow tour groups to go up to that place, but too many people had been pushed on the stairs or grabbed or scratched or had their hair pulled that he no longer felt it was safe to be up in that room. And he had, in fact, used to sleep in that room and had left the room and started sleeping in another part of the building when he woke up one night and heard growling and basically an invisible large dog in his description was clawing around his bed. And that, he said, was enough for him, and he moved to another part of the building. So that piqued my interest, that here was a place where no one was supposed to go. So I stopped by the next day. I happened to see him in the coffee house, and I walked in and said, introduced myself and said, let me go up there. I'd like to go up there. I'll go up alone. You have no responsibility if I get pushed or pulled or scratched, because I wanted to have that experience of going into a place that was supposed to be so haunted, and see if just that, having that in my mind, would make it feel different or creepy to me. He would not let me go up alone, but he agreed that if I came back with a group, that we could spend the night there. But he made sure, and he ended that sentence by saying, you can come and spend the night, but you won't make it through the night. That we would be chased out of the building, essentially, by the spirits or demons that were up there. So a couple of weeks later, this is an opportunity that every graduate student should have. I went and talked to my graduate students at Baylor, and I said, who wants to spend the night in a haunted house? And told them that they would need to take notes and observe, and they'd have to all pass me their field notes. But my co-authors and I, Joseph and Carson, and a small group of Baylor graduate students went and spent the night in this place. And when we got there, we were a little bit disappointed to find out that Dwayne, the warlock, had brought along two psychics, and the psychics were supposed to go along to protect us from the evil spirits. I was a little bit disappointed, because I had actually hoped that part of my hidden agenda of this was, I wanted to see if I brought a large group up there, if they would continue to get frightened and feed off each other over the night without any other input. But we ended up watching the psychics, which was just as interesting, because at one point one of them became possessed by the spirits after I'd annoyed the spirits. and she became possessed, so I was able to talk to a possessed person for a while, which was, it's a rare experience. We actually were able to spend the night up there. The psychics said that the spirits were so angry by our presence that they had to put a protective circle around us. So they put a circle of candles around us and did a ceremony, and we all slept within the circle. But my co-author Joseph actually agreed to be the control subject, and he slept outside the circle, but he's just fine.
Okay, well, that's good. He's been on our show before too, so we'll link to his podcast as well. He wasn't talking about this. One of the cool things that you do in this book, and I think many of our listeners might be chuckling a little bit now, is to kind of, you know, look at these folks as oddities or strange being, you know, people with mental illness or something. But actually what you do in your book is you take these people on their own terms, which is really neat. Discuss the approach that you have to studying the different subjects that you do.
Sure. And I'm frankly kind of surprised sometimes by the ignorance of the response when I talk about the people that I'm studying, where the typical response, even among academics, is, well, they're just crazy. These are clearly just mentally ill people. They're clearly just crazy. But to me, that undermines the whole premise of the social sciences, is that what is important from a purely social scientific perspective is not necessarily the objective reality of the belief system, but the effect that belief system has on people. Where it comes from, if we can predict where those beliefs come from demographic and other characteristics, and if we can assess the effects that having those beliefs have on other beliefs and attitudes. And I'm especially surprised when I get that response from people who study religion, because when we're studying religion, whatever the personal nature of your religious beliefs, the idea is that we are supposed to set those aside and examine if someone has this belief system, whatever it might be, whether someone's Mormon, Christian, Muslim, or a paranormalist. We're supposed to try to understand what are the predictors of those beliefs and what are the outcomes of those beliefs. And for me and for my co-authors, the actual nature of ghosts, Bigfoot, and UFOs is of no interest whatsoever. People ask me all the time if I believe in Bigfoot. My answer is just, I think it'd be fun if there was a Bigfoot, but it doesn't matter. As long as there are people out there who are looking for Bigfoot, there are people for me to study and try to understand how does this pursuit affect their lives. And the key thing about this book is it is not a book whatsoever about disproving or proving paranormal beliefs, and it's the former part, the fact that we're not disproving these beliefs, that have led me to get some very negative responses from some skeptical groups that have said, why aren't you, your job if you're going in here should be to try to prove or demonstrate that these people's beliefs have no merits. And I just do not see that as my role as a social scientist.
Yeah, and that's what makes the book really, really interesting here. So let's kind of dive into some of the findings that you have and start off by talking about both who subscribes to the paranormal, but also what their motivations are. But first, before we get into that, let's talk about what we mean by the paranormal. Give us the scope of that definition.
Sure. In our book, and my working definition of the paranormal is the paranormal is a phenomena or a set of beliefs that's trapped between two major societal institutions, science and religion. That and we consider the paranormal as phenomena that have essentially been doubly damned. That scientists consider the paranormal to be outside the bounds of reality, outside the bounds of credibility. And mainstream religious groups have said that the paranormal is outside of our belief system. It is something else. We can talk later about what that means, because different religious groups have different responses. But basically, religious groups are rejecting the paranormal, saying this is not our content. It's something else. And science is rejecting the paranormal and saying essentially this is invalid content. And religion falls in a different sphere, where religion essentially are those supernatural beliefs that science has not weighed in on, but the paranormal is trapped between religion and science. And so it consists of these phenomena which scientists say are invalid and religious groups say are invalid, and that places paranormalists in a really interesting place. How are they going to respond to being damned by both of these major societal institutions?
Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of who we are talking about before who we are talking about. What stuff would this encompass? I mean, ghosts are in there in that category. You've talked about Bigfoot as well. What other areas of inquiry would fall into this doubly damned category?
Sure. Other areas would include UFOs and encounters, you know, whether you just be seeing an object in the sky or having an encounter with a supposed alien being. It would include astrology, so believing you can tell your future or tell something about your personality by when you were born. Fortune tellers of all kinds, psychics, palm readers, people who have channel aliens or angels to tell you your future. Belief in ancient advanced civilizations such as Atlantis, these would all be classified as paranormal by our definition.
Okay. And then who are the folks that subscribe to this? Is it just one group of people, or is it scattered all across? And give us some sense for the demographics of paranormal beliefs in these different categories.
Sure. There are some factors which are fairly consistent across paranormal beliefs, and some that really vary. And that's one of the issues we talk about in the book quite a bit, is that the paranormal is complicated, and we can't just paint all these people with one brush and say this is a paranormalist, because in a certain sense it depends on not just what belief you're talking about, but how many of them you're holding simultaneously. But a few of the things which are fairly consistent are people who tend to believe in a variety of different paranormal topics, tend to be of a lower level of education, and also tend to have a lower level of income. That fits across fortune tellers, astrology, hauntings, Bigfoot. People who tend to believe in the paranormal, with some exceptions, also tend to be people who are not married or cohabitating. So tend to be people who are fairly free in terms of having a spouse, which is telling them to stop hunting ghosts or stop believing in Bigfoot. Other than that, it really varies by the type of phenomena we're talking about. Females are more likely to believe in certain types of phenomena, such as fortune telling and astrology. Males are more likely to be out there hunting UFOs and Bigfoot. So some of these factors are fairly consistent. Some of them are a little bit idiosyncratic, depending on the belief.
Okay. In terms of the connection with religion, are we finding that these folks are irreligious? Are they religious? Are they religious in certain denominations? How does that all fall into place?
Sure. Basically, what we find is the typical paranormal believer is somewhat religious. And this is important, the somewhat part, that I like to think of it as, if I had a book of UFOs to sell, what sort of audience would I want to get together in a room? I would not want to get together atheists. That what we find is that people who reject the idea of a god or gods, who believe there's nothing beyond the physical world, well, it's not surprising that they also reject all of this paranormal stuff. They don't believe that there's any reality to that there is a god. They also don't believe that there are aliens or ghosts running around. That makes sense. We also find that people who are in very strict religious groups or who are very committed to religion, and here I'm talking about those people who are going once a week, several times a week, that belong to stricter evangelical denominations, they also tend to be drawn away from the paranormal. So the person who tends to believe the most in the paranormal is someone who is a monthly attender, someone who's going to a church service every month, perhaps only on holidays, someone who believes, if we're talking about Christians, who believes that there is some merit to the Bible. They will not say the Bible is a book of stories. They also will not say that the Bible is the one and only word of God. They will fall into one of the middle categories when it comes to biblical literalism. They will tend to be in a more mainline denomination. They'll tend to be a Presbyterian. They'll tend to be Presbyterian. They'll tend to be United Methodist. They will not tend to be Jehovah's Witness or Mormon or LCMS or any of the stricter evangelical denominations. So basically, these are people who have indicated some willingness to believe in spiritual matters by having some connection, some interest in spiritual matters. But they are not people who also are essentially have all of their spiritual capital bound up by a very strict group.
Yeah, you talk about this in terms of the economics of religion perspective, which Iris is somewhat known for down there at Chapman University. And you talk about portfolio diversification. Explain that.
Sure. Well, the director of Iris here is Lawrence Yannikonian. He's a well-known economist of religion. And he talks about the idea. One of his works on portfolio diversification was very influential on this book and how we approach the study. That he argued basically that if you are someone who essentially has religious capital to spend, as an investor, it would make more sense for you to minimize the risk of any particular investment by spreading it around in many places. In other words, from a purely economic sense, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have all of your time, all of your money invested in one particular religion. Because what if that religion's wrong? You've lost your investment. So the safest investment is to have yourself spread out. But having yourself spread out is directly contrary to the needs of an organization. That a religious organization needs members and needs members that are committed to only their organization. Otherwise, they have a hard time mobilizing membership. They have a hard time with contributions. They're plagued with free riders, people who are belonging to the group but are not really of the group. So what Larry talks about in his work is that religious groups, if they want to have a committed membership, will find ways to ensure that people are not spreading their religious capital around. And one of the ways they do that is by placing strict requirements on members. That essentially, strict religious groups force you to be either fully committed or not be committed at all. Essentially, if you're going to be someone who is not committed, you're going to have to go somewhere else. And they do that by increasing the cost of belonging to the religious group. It could be by increasing the time that's required of you. It could be by having costly behavioral requirements that you have to dress a certain way, act a certain way, avoid certain behaviors. And when it comes to the paranormal, what you find is these strict religious groups, it's very interesting how they respond to the paranormal. That if you go to a Christian bookstore that is on the stricter side of the equation, and you look in their paranormal section, which they have a very interesting perspective on the paranormal, which is they say it's all demonic. That what we find when we find conservative religious group approaches to the paranormal is they don't just say that the paranormal, or most of them don't simply say the paranormal is just misguided, that there are no UFOs, and therefore you're wasting your time. What the more conservative religious groups tend to say is those UFOs are real, they just aren't what you think they are. The UFOs are actually Satan masking himself to try to attract you away from religion. So in very strict religious groups, you will find messages that it is actually harmful to your soul, sinful, directly harmful to the group if you are examining UFOs, examining ghosts, playing with Ouija boards. I even have a book in my office that's a paranormal book that was written by a very conservative religious press that says that only atheists will ever see Bigfoot. So what we see going on there essentially is that the paranormal is directly threatening to religious groups because it's a behavior or phenomenon out there which can take people's time and money and motivation away from religious groups. And the very strict ones respond to that by directly demonizing the paranormal and telling you cannot do that.
Yeah, you have a very interesting chapter on this in the book where you point out the fact that many monotheistic religions are not necessarily monotheistic when it comes to the paranormal, but then start talking about demons and Satanism and all this stuff. And there's seems to have been an uptick in the number of exorcisms that we've heard about in the news in, I don't know, the past year or two. Any thoughts on why that is occurring, or just the general reflections on how some of these stricter churches might be seen as kind of dabbling in the paranormal themselves?
Yes, well, the two responses to that. First, we generally see upticks in beliefs about either that there's satanic cults, hidden underground satanic cults, and upticks in exorcisms and those type of phenomena in times of uncertainty or perceived uncertainty. And what I see, either conspiracy theories about the devil or exorcisms are, is essentially personifying evil. And personifying evil is very comforting to some people because it's much preferable to some people to believe that there is an actual face to evil than to simply believe that evil is random and unpredictable. But on top of that, we have seen with an interest in the paranormal that even amongst mainstream churches, there's these topics which we call crossover topics, and these are the ones that are more difficult to define. That when it comes to exorcisms, when it comes to encounters with guardian angels, these are phenomena which you can find both in churches and amongst paranormal groups. It's just the way that they speak of those phenomena differ. That if you find a paranormalist who is not very religious, they talk about demonic entities as just essentially another type of ghost, just a nastier one. Whereas, obviously, churches talk about demons within a broader theology of heaven and hell. And guardian angel experiences, you will find at psychic fairs and amongst paranormalists lots of discussion of guardian angels. And if you read a book on guardian angels that's written for a paranormalist, they will talk about them almost as if they're Bigfoot sightings. They'll just talk about, here's a person, they've sighted this, here's the experience they had, but won't talk about the broader theological implications of them actually seeing an angel.
One of the stories that was very interesting to me, because it comes from Washington State, and you've done a lot of research up here, being that this is a place you grew up in, and for some reason or another, the Washington State weather kind of makes for paranormal activity. You talk about this woman, Laura, from Auburn, who blends together a lot of these things. Tell us about her.
Sure. Well, Laura's a wonderful woman from Auburn, and she's someone I got to know. First got to know when I started spending time with a support group for people who believe they've been abducted by aliens. Runs very similar to, say, an Alcoholics Anonymous group, where you have a group of people who get together for support. They share their experiences and their story, and they give each other moral support and talk about what they can do to try to avoid negative experiences with aliens. And that's where I first met her. That's where I first got to know her and was fascinated with someone who was claiming these experiences. But as I got to know her over time, I realized that she was one of these people that Larry Anaconi would talk about as having an extremely diversified portfolio. And I was really stunned at how many of these things she was believing in simultaneously. That she said she was a Christian, although she wasn't going to a church. She said she found a lot of merit in the Bible. At the same time, she also considered herself a Native American spiritualist. She had a very strong belief in Bigfoot and actually told me at great length one day about multiple different varieties of Bigfoot that live around the world. She has had UFO experiences. She's had training to be a psychic. She believes in astrology. She believes that the Earth is populated with hidden cities from civilizations such as Atlantis. So this was a person who literally believed in everything. She was, you could put almost any paranormal or religious belief to her, and she would say that she found some merit in it, which I found fascinating that someone could believe in all of these things all at once.
Kind of goes what you're saying with that portfolio investment and the type of person that might be associated with these kind of different beliefs. The question that comes up, and one that you explore as well, is why would people believe this? Now, you already mentioned that some people like to see evil personified so that it's something that they can wrestle with rather than just being this amorphous thing that just maybe can never be resolved. What are some of the other reasons people adhere to many of these paranormal beliefs?
Sure, and here, you know, here I have to be clear that this is from my conversations with people. This is not from we have not done a survey yet where we specifically asked people the origin of or why they believe in the paranormal. But what I've found from people over time is several things. The first is that I've found amongst people a real need, and they will talk about this need to believe that there is something more out there than just the physical world. And these are people who, for whatever reason, are not drawn to contemporary or the predominant social theories or religions out there. And this is how they find it. This is how they find their spirituality is in looking for ghosts and Bigfoot and UFOs and the like. Another that I found is that people really, find the idea of being able to be part of a major discovery very exciting. That, one of the things that I could only have learned from spending so much time with these people is not in the physical sense, the high that people are on when they're getting ready, this feeling that anything could happen at this point, that there could be a ghost in this room, and the excitement that they feel when they're getting out their equipment and they're ready to sense something, that this becomes almost an addiction to people, the idea that this might be the time that we actually find evidence of a ghost or a Bigfoot is very attractive to these people.
Yeah, now you've been on a number of Bigfoot hunts, and you've seen this firsthand. You've also been to a number of psychic fairs and paranormal fairs. Tell us what goes on here, and how do you, you know, again, talking with these people, they're very excited about the possibility of a new discovery just on the horizon. This is going to be the time that we actually find Bigfoot, or the fact that they're trying to find something more, this spiritual growth. Give us a sense of what you find at these fairs.
Sure. At the psychic fairs, and I've been to many of them, both in getting readings myself and watching other people get readings, I see this, this real, need to feel like there is more to my life than what is currently happening. That, psychic fairs actually I find a little bit sad, actually. Not sad in the condescending sense, but sad in the sense that who I tend to see at psychic fairs are people who feel like their life is not going the way that they want it to. People who feel like they deserve something more out of life and they aren't getting it. People who are working, this is not me saying this, I'm actually quoting someone I remember that I saw at a psychic fair back when I was writing the book, who said that she was in a dead-end job and that she always dreamed she would have something more than just working in an office, and she wanted to believe that there was more out there. And at this reading I was at, in this case, it was a group of people in a room, and a woman who claimed that she could contact your personal guardian angel was speaking to the group. The channeler contacted this woman's guardian angel and told her that her guardian angel was an elderly Chinese man and that she had a mission. And this woman's mission was to help promote healing, and that she had a greater purpose in life, and that purpose was very important. It would change the world. And when this woman heard that, she just had an immediate emotional reaction and started crying and said, I knew that. And I see that over and over again, that particularly at psychic fairs, that I see people And this, again, I've got to be clear, it's just this is my personal non-random observations. It's what I've seen here in the time that I've spent. But I see a great need to believe, and I see the people that are there are there because they feel like something is wrong and they want a clear answer. They don't want to live lives of uncertainty. They want to feel like something greater is in their future.
You talk about the organizational aspect of this. You go to paranormal conferences or the psychic fairs, and it's an attempt to bring a number of people together. And a lot of what we would call mainline religions do organize into formalized institutional groups. To what extent do some of these paranormal ideas organize themselves into these groups? Are there ones that are easier to organize into groups than others? What do you find on that front?
Sure. Well, a couple of things is that Stark and Bainbridge and Rodney Stark and William Bainbridge talk a lot in one of their books. I highly recommend The Future of Religion. They talk about how religious groups and religious beliefs organize over time. And they talk about how at their initial stage of development, religious ideas are at levels such as the audience level and the client level. And the audience level is when you essentially have groups of people coming together who don't know one another for some sort of ephemeral event where they're hearing someone tell them about something spiritual or religious. And client phenomena are when people actually start to develop a one-on-one relationship with a particular person who is a vendor of some sort of religious or spiritual experiences or beliefs. And these are all levels of organization that Stark and Bainbridge consider below the level of what we know as organized religious groups. And that's where all the paranormal is. So it's possible with the paranormal we are seeing a window into the future, that we are seeing a belief system which is below that level of organization, which may one day organize into religious groups. And we've seen very limited examples of this where there actually are some bona fide UFO religions operating in the United States. They're small. Granted, they are small, but the Aetherius Society is out there. Scientology has UFO beliefs heavily a part of its theology. And there are other religious groups such as Unarius that are out there operating as religious groups. So we're just starting to see the first hints that these belief systems might start to organize more. But to answer your second question, the groups that I see that are the most organized are the ones that are related to what we call in the book discovery, which are paranormal phenomena which are conducive or supposedly conducive to actually being documented or captured. That you have phenomena which, such as psychic phenomena, getting a crystal ball reading, having your palms read, having your angel speak to you, all of which I've experienced, which are more about your personal belief, more about personally becoming enlightened. You have other sorts of belief systems, such as in Bigfoot or UFOs, where the focus is on trying to prove that those things are real, not to just yourself, but to society as a whole. And we find that those discovery groups are the ones that have become the most organized, that all around this country, there are groups organized around the hunt for Bigfoot and the hunt for UFOs and the hunt for ghosts. In fact, these groups are becoming so prevalent that there can actually be waiting lists at famous haunted houses for ghost hunting groups to get in. And it's well known in the Bigfoot community that Bigfoot hunters may actually be hearing what other Bigfoot hunters are doing when they're in the woods. It's a problem. That Bigfoot hunters, one of the things that Bigfoot hunters do is they like to do what's called call blasting, where they scream or play sounds of supposedly a Bigfoot screaming to see if they'll get a response. And there have been several cases Bigfoot hunters talk about where one Bigfoot hunting group screams and a Bigfoot hunting group on the next ridge over screams back at them. So these groups are starting to organize. They're becoming much more prevalent. The question is, will these groups start to develop a more religious component to them over time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I live in an area where there's a lot of that activity going around out here in western Washington and just up in the hills of the Cascades. I'm not surprised that you would find that kind of thing going on. One of the chapters at the very end of your book, and I think this is relatively new. I'm trying to think back to the older edition of your book. You talk about the future of the paranormal. And this is really interesting in light of a lot of ink that's been spilled on the rise of religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, here in the United States. And, you know, a lot of talk in circles of sociology circles saying, well, secularization theory just came late to the United States, and we're finally getting rid of all these supernatural beliefs and all those kind of things. The younger folks have finally caught on to this. How does this play out with supernatural beliefs? What, if you could metaphorically take your crystal ball and project this a little bit forward, what are you seeing?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's unfortunately embarrassing that we have so many people who think that nuns means that spiritual and religious beliefs are going away. That that the clear evidence and is that over time trends of deinstitutionalization are happening. That people are drifting away at an increasing rate. We can different sociologists of religion would argue about what that rate is and how accelerated that rate is, but what appears to be clear is that over time, more and more people are drifting away from organized forms of religion. But what people seem to be less aware of is when those people are drifting away from organized religion, it does not mean that they're doing it because they're leaving those religious beliefs behind. But you find amongst nuns actually quite high levels of what you might call mainstream Christian beliefs. Amongst these nuns, still high levels of belief that there's some merit to the Bible. Still quite high beliefs in the divinity of Jesus amongst people who are in the nun category. And you also find among the nuns quite high levels of paranormal belief. So since we see as one of the large constraints on paranormal belief, religious or organized religious groups demonizing paranormal belief in order to keep their members from spreading their portfolios around, the rising numbers of the nuns means to myself and my co-authors rising belief in the paranormal. These are people who have essentially been freed from constraints on spreading their belief around, and we expect that will be associated with higher levels of belief in these paranormal phenomena over time.
Some interesting stuff to see how that plays out in these surveys. And you're a person who does a lot of these surveys and is always looking at the trends. One of the things that you've done recently, and just kind of move away from the book on the paranormal right now to your other project on the study of fear, and you've done three waves of examination on American fear. Tell us what this project is and what you're finding.
Sure. Well, the goal of this project really was to, it goes along with the idea of what I told you earlier, that I'm fascinated in the effect that beliefs have on people. I'm not particularly as interested in the merit of those beliefs. I want to understand the effect they have on people. And one thing that we've seen increasingly over the last couple of decades in both our discourse about crime and the nature of society and in political discussions is a lot of discussion about fear. Fear of criminals, fear of terrorists, fear of the government, fear of economic changes. But other than what you might call these snap polls where you have a MSNBC or Fox News or CNN will do a one-off poll where they ask how afraid Americans are of something, clowns or the government or something like that. There hasn't been a systematic examination over time of what our fears are, how they're growing, how we can predict who has those fears, and most importantly, how those fears affect people's behavior and how they feel about other social issues. And that's where we're stepping in, that we're going to try to understand fear over time and the effects that it has on people. So the first thing that we're trying to do is, in these first few years, we're trying to set up a baseline so that we can understand a survey like this pays off the most over the long term, so we can find out in 10 years whatever's happened in the political sphere, has fear of government and government corruption and economic fears, have they gone up or down, and what societal trends can affect these beliefs and these changes. But what interests me the most, frankly, is trying to understand what Americans believe about society and how that affects their fears. And to me, the most interesting finding is that Americans are actually, this is one of the few times where I can say this pretty definitively, they're absolutely wrong on crime. They're just wrong. what we asked our random sample of Americans are about a series of crimes ranging from the most horrific crimes such as serial killings and stranger abductions of children down to muggings and sexual assaults. Has this particular type of crime gone down dramatically, gone down a little bit, stayed about the same, gone up a little bit, or gone up dramatically over the last 20 years? And vast majorities of Americans, more than you usually see on a survey question like this, say that all those crimes have gone up dramatically, and they're just this is one case where we can say they're just wrong. The statistics show over time, there's blips here and there, obviously, and it's a little bit of a question whether the violent crime rate is going a little bit up right now. But if you look at a trend over the last 40 years, you see a consistent downward trend that Americans are safer now from stranger abductions and serial killings, which were always rare, very rare crimes to begin with, and they ever have been. But if you tell someone on the street about this, I've found you actually get an angry reaction. For whatever reason in our society, Americans either just believe so strongly that they think just some academic who has his head in the clouds doesn't understand, or they have some emotional reason to believe. They believe society is getting more and more and more dangerous over time. The problem is, it's extremely clear from our data that belief that is incorrect, that crime is going way up, is the strongest predictor of what people believe we should do with criminals. And what people believe we should do with criminals is be more and more harsh with them. Take away all their privileges, keep them in there longer. Younger people should be allowed to get the death penalty. And we can argue, criminologists can argue about the merit of all of those proposals, and we could argue about whether it's good to be harsher on criminals or not. The point is not that. The point is people's belief about what we should do with criminals is coming from a flawed premise. It's coming from a flawed belief that they have, and that belief trumps everything else. It trumps your political affiliation, trumps your education, your income, trumps your religious affiliation, your religious beliefs. So those are the type of phenomena that we're interested in, because it really gets to the heart of this idea, which is very sociological. At the heart of social science, in my opinion, is trying to understand how these beliefs that people hold can affect their behaviors.
Let me just kind of probe you on this a little bit as you're talking about. Do you think this is something that's been historically consistent, or has it been something more an effect of our modern media culture? I know you're dealing with surveys that you've only done for, you know, a few years now just to get a baseline, but do you have any intuitions on that?
I do. I mean, I'll give you the safe answer first, and you hit right on it, that unfortunately, since people have not been conducting these surveys systematically over the years, I have no way to compare back to the 1970s, which is a drag. I wish we could. But my expectation is that, yes, our modern media, the way it operates, the way we get our information, has a huge effect on our fears. And part of that has to do with the way we can get our information. That I talk to my students about this all the time, that if you hear about a serial killer on the news, if a new one hits the news today, and that serial killer has a particular MO, whatever they might be, maybe they're a Satanist, or maybe they kill a certain type of person, you will oftentimes, not all the time, but oftentimes hear the media then talk about the new trend, that this is a new thing which is happening. And what they will do is they will go and find every other case where someone has been killed or victimized in this very strange way. With the access to the internet, you can type in something random and you will find multiple examples of it. Because in a country of over 300 million people, there's always a couple people doing very strange things. And in a world of many billion people, there's always going to be people doing very strange things. The problem that we're finding, and we see this in our focus groups and we're talking to people, is when they simply find another example of whatever idiosyncratic case or nearly idiosyncratic case that they find, they take that as evidence that there's more of it going on than ever before, that this is a new trend. And that's a problem, because it's hard to solve that and get people out of that way of thinking. What I joke with when I'm talking to groups about this is, now that we have entire channels devoted to serial killings and strange crimes like Investigation Discovery, if you sit there and watch Investigation Discovery all day, you will see 10 different serial killers, and that may convince you to be more frightened of strangers than ever before. But I'm trying to tell you, calm down. You've seen all 10. That's them. That's all 10. As long as you don't see those 10 people, it's okay. Go out and talk to strangers. Go out and spend your time in public places. And the thing that really concerns me about these beliefs people are getting from the way they look up information these days is criminologists know that when you create empty spaces, when we start abandoning our parks because we're afraid they're filled with pedophiles or serial killers, you create a space, you create a vacuum where actually those types of people may move in.
Some of a self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, fascinating stuff, and we'll have to keep track of that and see what you're doing with the fear stuff as well as your investigations or your scholarship on measuring religion. You're one of my favorite people to talk to on all this kind of stuff, and we'll point people back to the data archives that you work with. I want to finish off with one final question that I've grown accustomed to asking all my guests now, and that's a reflection upon the scholarship they've done over the years. And as we mentioned in your bio at the beginning of this interview, you've been talking about paranormal and these different types of phenomena, fear, and all that stuff for about 20 years. Is there anything that you have learned that has changed your mind about society or human nature over the course of that 20 years, or anything that you found really surprising that, again, you look back in your graduate days at the University of Washington and said, you know, I never thought I would have believed that, but here I am now in 2016, and it's a different story.
Sure, I can tell you one thing, and it's a message I try to bring my students all the time. I use the term with my students now, they're crazy is lazy. When I first started delving into the paranormal, when I first started studying fringe religious groups, I've spent time with groups like the Westboro Baptist Church, all sorts of groups like that, that my reflexive thinking on them early in my career was that, well, these are just crazy people. These are just people who have or who are fundamentally different than I am, that they have some sort of problem or mental illness. And the more time I spend with people of all types, the more I find that if you can take the perspective, which I would call a rational choice perspective, of assuming that everyone who engages in a behavior, there are rewards and costs associated with that behavior. And if we could understand that reward and cost structure, we could start to predict their behavior. And I have been entirely convinced by that perspective over time that that I find the behavior of paranormalists, I find the behavior of the Westboro Baptist Church, I find the behavior of any fringe group that I look at entirely predictable and understandable within their worldview. Doesn't mean I agree with it. Doesn't mean I agree with it at all. But the point is, as social scientists, we should be trying to understand behavior in a way that's predictable. And over the years, I have entirely lost, and it was a very fundamental change for me as I started spending time with these groups, realizing that there is a fundamental logic. It's an internal logic that undergirds these people and what they do. And that's what our goal should be, is to not reflexively assign a group just this label of they're crazy or they're extreme. We shouldn't get to know them. The more extreme the group, the more we don't understand them, the more time we might want to spend time with them. And if you find that group offensive, learn their underlying logical structure, and you can understand how we might prevent those kind of groups in the future.
And your work does that extremely well. I want to recommend people to your books, The Paranormal America, coming out in its second edition here in a few weeks, as well as America's Four Gods, which you've done before. So my guest today has been Chris Bader. Chris, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.